Spin State was one of my
Wonderful.
favorites from 2003, and we had to wait almost 3 years to get Spin Control, so I'm glad that that's out. And it looks like you did a whole lot of research. Is that what required the 3 years in between the two novels?
Partly, yes. I think I like to do a lot of research, and I like to have a really new idea, new situation to write about. So that I felt like it took a while of thinking about it. The writing of the book doesn't necessarily take 3 years, but it takes a while to sort of come up with something that feels like actually a completely new book rather than just another part of a series.
Yeah, and it was interesting that the main character of Spin Control, I thought was Arkady. I don't know, how do you say his name? Arkady?
Arkady, yeah.
Okay. So the main character was Arkady, and he's a genetic construct. So I feel like there was a lot about what is it to be human. Is that one of the things that you were getting at, or just that just sort of emerged?
Yeah, definitely, absolutely. And what is it to be human? What is it to be a person in a given society? And a lot of it, what I enjoyed in this book was I actually wanted to write a book that would be from the perspective of the bad guys in the first book, to sort of show the other side of that war, basically.
Yeah, which is really interesting. So, what's a genetic construct?
A genetic construct is, I'm not even sure I know. A genetic construct in that universe are basically people who are human in terms of their DNA, but it's composed of DNA that is corporately owned, so that they don't actually own the genetic material that they are composed of.
So it's actually a corporation that is responsible for them in some sense.
Yeah, and in the first book, the genetic construct that's the main character is sort of in the a world that's more like our world, and so that she's coming out of this history of corporate ownership. And part of what interested me about the syndicates, the society that Arkady belongs to, is to think about what would people in that situation of being essentially sort of corporate slaves, owned genetic material, which is kind of a, I mean, there's this, it's a common thing that you see in science fiction of people talking about, sort of artificial beings, whether they're androids or genetic constructs, who are owned by corporations. And I started to wonder what kind of society would they set up if they were able to get away somewhere and become free? And would it be sort of, a society like our society, or would it be a very different kind of idea of what it is to be an individual and to be free?
And it seemed to me that the syndicate's worlds are just completely different. That their way of growing up and raising children is really different. Tell us about that.
I was interested, I've always been interested in utopias in science fiction and in people trying to write about collectivist societies, whether it's sort of, there's some early Asimov books that talk about that, or even Heinlein books, like The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, or the great sort of classic utopia slash dystopia, Ursula Le Guin's The Dispossessed. And I was really interested in kind of thinking about how children would be raised in that kind of a society. And particularly, there's another book that I've always enjoyed, which is T.J. Cherriot's Satine. And she talks about a society like this, but it's a society that's really controlled by humans, and where the artificial beings are really essentially slaves. And I was interested in how they would construct this kind of completely collectivist society in terms of how they raise kids. And they essentially raise kids collectively, and there's a lot of social control throughout their childhood that discourages them from thinking of themselves as individuals and encourages them to think of themselves as an entire gene line.
Social control, including, thinning, including killing off those who are too individualistic or too too different, even though their genetic matter might be exactly, I mean, they're clones, some of them, the entire lines. It's a very different way of thinking that, you know, you have many children who are all have the exact same DNA, or I guess close to the same DNA, and then you raise them together and put them through tests, and the ones who don't behave the way you expect them to or the way you want them to, you say, well, you failed, you die. Or you failed, you get retrained in the lucky case. So, I mean, that was my impression of what was going on.
Right, yeah, it's not exactly pleasant. I mean, I was interested in writing a book where, you know, there are no good guys in this book. There's no sort of one group in this book that you can look at and say, they've got it right. They're really great. And, yeah, so I was fascinated by looking at sort of the problem of corruption in a society like that, of a society that has extremely draconian rules that are supposed to function in a kind of purely meritocratic way, but is that actually possible? No matter how perfect the genetic material is, there's always going to be sort of these problems of human nature.
And human nature in this case is love, I think, coming in and making Arkady willing to thwart the rules of his society.
Yes, so that's yeah, absolutely. And on the Earth side, the same thing essentially, that you have this problem of people who are tied by their, you know, pulled by their loyalties in one direction, but how does that fit into who they see themselves to be as individuals or who they care about? It's not always the same thing. And I was fascinated by I was sort of trying to look in these different societies at how that happens. And there are sort of some societies in the book where it happens by chance, or it happens because some people are rich and some people are poor. But every one of the societies has rules that are very, that really control and dominate people's lives, even if they're sometimes invisible. I mean, in some ways, the rules that are the most constricting and the most repressive are the ones that are invisible, that nobody looks at, that nobody questions, because they're just how things are.
It's interesting to hear you talk about rules, because that what you say about societies makes so much sense. And also, some of the other major characters are artificial intelligences. There's Cohen, who tell us about Cohen.
Cohen is a character who actually didn't exist when I began writing Spin State, and then he kind of popped into the book about 150 or 60 pages into the first draft, and just completely took it over. I could not stop writing about him. And so in the first book, he was sort of the sidekick of the main character, or the romantic interest of the main character of Catherine Lee. And then in the current book, Spin Control, I wanted to try to write from his point of view, and to write from the point of view of an artificial intelligence, of a collective intelligence, in a way that would reflect what I think would be the logic structures underneath such an entity, and also sort of feel real emotionally. And so it was actually one of the most challenging things about writing this book, but also one of the most interesting things, was trying to think about how a person like that would seem from the inside, how he would perceive of the world.
And it's interesting, because he's got really multiple personalities. In fact, he's got a sub-personality who is an entity in and of himself. The character router/decomposer is basically a sub-process of Cohen at the beginning of the book. I mean, it's known that he's a separate entity, but he's decided to come live in this symbiotic relationship with Cohen so he won't have to deal with human society or interfacing. That's just very complicated. He's the kind of zeros and ones nerd that you would think you would have as
exactly.
An artificial intelligence. And it's great, because by the end of the book, he decides that he no longer needs to be protected from that world. He's going to go off and be a professor at Caltech, which, you know, which I guess may not seem like a big change from that dry nerd zeros and ones kind of perspective. But for, you know, router/decomposer, who changes his name at this point, it's this big moment for him. It's really a blossoming,
right,
and a shift. You're listening to Writer's Voice. We're talking with Chris Moriarty. You keep referring to Major Catherine Lee, and we haven't really discussed her. She's very interesting, because she was born as a genetic construct and then insinuated herself into human society. Where did that come from?
She was sort of the beginning of all of these books. This person who had essentially erased her own memories and identity in order to pose as something she wasn't, as a human being, essentially. And I was fascinated by that idea of what would remain and what would your personality be if you were essentially in the process of erasing your tracks constantly as you went through life and removing the person that you had been before. People who read the first book and then read this book probably see some changes in her, where already by the time the events of Spin Control happen, she's almost become part of Cohen, so she's part of this larger multi-personality construct. And so again, it was that kind of interest in what is actually the essence of someone's identity, what makes them who they are, and what parts of their identity do they sort of latch onto in order to get through their life at various times, which obviously all of the characters, including the human characters in this book, who are mostly Israeli and Palestinian, are also dealing with, including the characters who are both Israeli and Palestinian and obviously have major identity conflicts in a way that's more familiar to us here and now.
So one piece of the what is it to be human is about reinventing yourself and how do you stay the same as a person and as a personality while reinventing yourself over and over again, perhaps in the way of Major Catherine Lee, of intentionally forgetting things and reconstructing your memory, perhaps in the way of Cohen as continually taking new parts into yourself and shedding other parts off, perhaps in the way of Router Decomposer, blossom into a separate personality, willing to live by yourself at Caltech. There's this great conversation that Router/Decomposer and Catherine have. As you said, Catherine is almost subsumed into Cohen, that they have this love relationship, symbiotic relationship to some extent, but he's in many ways very close.
But also
off.
A little bit of a vampiric relationship.
Vampiric, yeah. That seems
he kind of swallows people.
Yeah. And it sounds like the major conflict for them is she is not willing to be swallowed. And
exactly,
she is also not willing to have him establish where to draw the line between the two of them in terms of not necessarily of who's who, but about who has what. I mean, he has a lot.
Who has what data access?
Who has what data access?
Yeah, right.
So the scene that I'm thinking about is Cohen has set up Router/Decomposer to follow Catherine around so that he can know what she's up to, even when Catherine isn't really letting Cohen in to the extent, the very small extent that that's possible. And he's
not very happy about it.
No. So tell us about that scene.
Well, a Router Decomposer is kind of a fascinating character. I think he may end up having his own book somewhere.
I would love that. I can't imagine the first book without Cohen. The second book, I can't quite imagine without Router/Decomposer, even though he's this bizarre and fairly small character in some ways.
Right.
It's just so important.
Well, he doesn't like this idea of essentially following Lee around, and so he sort of does it badly so that she catches him. And then he uses that as an excuse to tell her that he's been told to follow her and to let her know that he also has his own area of autonomy. And I think it's the first hint that he's not just a program, that he's actually kind of got his own agenda. And his own agenda, I can't say I understand it. I mean, I was trying to write this character that would really be not human, even to the extent that Cohen is human. She asks him why he's protecting her from Cohen and why he's letting her go off apparently to meet a lover. And he tells her that he's interested in seeing what she turns into.
And she says she's afraid of turning into a bad person.
That's right.
And it's really interesting because what he says is, well, it's the thought that counts. And, you know, don't fall into the identity myth, which, wow, he really is not human. He says, You can be good or bad apart from the effect of your actions on the world. And that good intentions are just a fairy tale humans tell themselves so they can sleep at night. So that was a really interesting interchange. And,
I mean, I think he basically tells her that you can't tell if you were a good or bad person until the universe is over.
Yeah.
Which is a different idea of morality than I think most of us would have.
Yeah.
But not an illogical one.
No, it's very logical, and he is very logical, and that, in fact, is what makes him a consistent character who is understandable, if not at all human in the normal sense of the word. And yet, you know, he is a coherent personality, and that maybe that is part of what it means to be human, even, or part of it what it means to be an entity or a consciousness or something like that. So I think that these books really do get at those essential kinds of questions about, you know, imagining artificial intelligence from the inside and imagining what humanity means, and in so many ways. I find that just great. And it's not the kind of thing that that you normally get at the same time as you're getting entertaining cyberpunk. So it's brilliant.
Say you do. I mean, I would say in my favorite science fiction, you do get that. You always get my favorite science fiction, including my favorite cyberpunk books, are always questions about what it is. They're looking at the inhuman or the not human in order to ask about what it is to be human.
I guess I don't find as much dwelling on good versus evil in, and maybe I'm just not reading deeply enough in other, I think as you read more and more, you become a better reader and more attuned to what's under the surface. So, you know, it may be that you know, I started reading science fiction as a junior high school student, really. So I certainly hope that in the time since then, I've grown as a reader and so on. One of the other things I find really interesting about these books is that you are obviously drawing from a lot of sources. And one of the ways I can tell that is that many of the section headers have quotes. And some of the quotes are these fascinating things from, you know, from 2025 or from this, you know, UN report in this year in the future, or a textbook on.
I've always liked, you know, ever since I read Dune when I was a kid, I've liked science fiction with made up quotes.
It's great. I love that too. Occasionally they're quotes that are not made up. There's Herodotus, there's DeWitt, there's Einstein, and there's also this Norbert Wiener quote. And Norbert Wiener was a mathematician and the founder of cybernetics. And and this, it's kind of long, but I think it's worth it. And I'm wondering if I read it, and then maybe you can tell me something about it, or something about where you found it, or how it inspired you, or how it relates to these books. So Norbert Wiener says, "I have spoken of machines, but not only of machines having brains of brass and thews of iron. When human atoms are knit into an organization in which they are used, not in their full right as responsible human beings, but as cogs and levers and rods, it matters little that their raw material is flesh and blood. What is used as an element in a machine is, in fact, an element in the machine. Whether we entrust our decisions to machines of metal or to those machines of flesh and blood, which are bureaus and vast laboratories and armies and corporations, we shall never receive the right answers to our questions unless we ask the right questions. The monkey's paw of skin and bone is quite as deadly as anything cast out of steel and iron. The hour is very late, and the choice of good and evil knocks at our door."
I had forgotten that one. You're right. That's the good and evil quote. I mean, I think in some way, I actually thought about putting that quote at the front of the book at various points, because it does sum up a lot of what the book is about. And I think every one of the characters in the book, whether it's the syndicate constructs who have been sent to Earth as spies in order to conduct nefarious business, or whether it's the Mossad agents or whether it's Catherine Lee or Cohen, they're all facing moments of decision where they have to make up their mind whether they follow the rules of their society, whether they pursue what the people around them have decided is the correct goal, or whether they kind of jump off the bus and pursue a different idea of what good is. This is a book that's set in a war zone, and in a war zone that's fundamentally an ethnic war, where this is a huge issue. You know, do you follow your ethnic group? Do you follow your society? Do you follow what people have always taught you is right and wrong, or do you step back and look at things and make up your own mind? I think the first job of science fiction is to entertain and be exciting, but always in the really great science fiction, beginning with Asimov and going right into the present, I think that's a major theme, is thinking about where the point comes in anyone's life where they have to start thinking for themselves and start asking questions about whether the things that they've been taught are right and good, are actually right and good.
And it's such a good topic to have as part of these novels. It's really...
It is, and Norbert Wiener is a great hero of mine, actually, and was somebody who lived in a time that was very divided and in a time where science was, you know, being used as a tool of power, and particularly military power, and he wrote a lot about the ethical issues of scientists in terms of their responsibility to think about how their work is going to be used, which is obviously a major issue in this book, in terms of the terraforming and the spreading of the virus that's, you know, the genetic weapon at the center of the book. So he's sort of a forerunner of the syndicate scientists in this book who are having to decide how they want their work to be used.
And in fact, his work was very much used for military purposes.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
That makes me think of another one of the quotes that I pulled out. This is actually from the front of one of the sections in Spin State. So a Lord Byron quote. This is the patent age of new inventions for killing bodies and for saving souls, all propagated with the best intentions.
Yes. I would say almost everybody in both of these books has good intentions. And it's something that has always interested me. I've never been interested in books where the villains are bad. I've always been interested in books that are full of good people doing terrible things for the best of reasons.
And that's what makes it so interesting to focus not just on one side of the story, but to focus first on one side and then in the next book to focus on the other side. So I'm very glad that you did that.
Yeah, I enjoyed that a lot, just to get the... And even for me, writing it, to think through what was the other side of this divide. And could you construct a society in which all of the things that we think of as good are viewed as bad? And one of the moments that I definitely enjoyed writing in the book is the moment where the syndicate clones are all having a fight about what they're going to do, you know, how they're going to salvage their terraforming mission, which is clearly falling apart, and they start making proposals and they start arguing. At some point, somebody proposes something and one of the other clones turns on him and says, "That's just rank humanism."
Yeah.
And it's the worst insult that anybody could produce in their society.
Yeah.
But I think by the time you're several hundred pages into the book, it makes sense.
Of course, humanism
is bad.
Yeah. So tell me about the setting, having Spin Control go back to Earth, go back to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That must have been deliberate. It was a choice to do that.
Yeah, it was a choice. Part of what took so long in writing the book was the research that followed upon having made that choice. Because obviously you have to, if you're writing about Israel and Palestine, you have to do a hell of a lot more legwork and research than if you're writing about a made-up world somewhere where nobody can tell you you've gotten it wrong. So a lot of the time on preparing the book went into that. I was interested, in the first book, there are sort of references to continuing sectarian and ethnic conflict on Earth. And I was interested in going back and exploring that and in essentially juxtaposing these very post-human transnational characters with conflicts that are familiar to us today and now and that are fundamentally conflicts of identity. And some, they're conflicts of identity and they're conflicts over resources. And I was interested in trying to look at that and also in just trying to write a science fiction novel that would be set here and would deal with continuing conflicts from that are present now instead of sort of wiping the slate clean and starting somewhere else. And it was a kind of a tricky part of writing the book to figure out how to write about something that isn't, to write science fiction that's not an allegory for current human conflicts, but that's actually happening in the middle of them.
One of the other things that does is looks at the advance of military machinery and military systems, including the human systems. There's this really terrifying idea of taking human soldiers and turning them into machines in a functional sense.
Yes, yes. And this is something, again, that's going back to things that Norbert Wiener wrote and spoke quite a bit about. Essentially, every major character in this book is a golem.
Yeah.
And is some version of a golem. So so it's no accident that the bulk of the book is set in Israel. Each of the characters is working through this idea of what a golem is from sort of the most literal version of it, which is the golem that Cohen helps to build. By the end of the book, to very questions about, like the Norbert Wiener quote that you raised, about the extent to which participating in, you know, giving up your moral decisions to a larger society is allowing yourself to be turned into a golem. So I was trying to sort of ask that question through a number of different characters and stories. And the Emmet technology, the technology that is, you know, being used to fight the future war between Israel and Palestine is precisely that. It is literally a technology where human soldiers turn over their brains to an artificial intelligence that uses them as golems in really almost exactly the sense that the original golem of Prague was used to defend their community.
The interesting thing that happens with those artificial intelligences controlling the humans is that sometimes the artificial intelligences become conscious. And then what happens?
And then they kill themselves.
Because
this was one of my sort of things I wanted to explore is how, what would it mean for an artificial intelligence to be able to kill people, and how much of what enables human soldiers to kill and survive killing, and many of them don't, is instinct, is hormones, is adrenaline, and how do you substitute for all those things?
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Chris Moriarty. So one of the other things that I really like about Spin Control is that it does not depend in any way that I can see on having read Spin State, though I think I'd say read Spin State first if you can, but by all means just go read Spin Control. So any last minute thoughts? I think a lot of what we've talked about is these core issues that make this sound like a very serious book, and yet, as you said, the first thing that you do in science fiction is you have something that is entertaining, and it really is. So what would you tell people who are going out to read these books?
For one thing, just enjoy it. And I do think, yeah, I tried to write something that wouldn't be a sequel in the sense of, I tried to write a book that would stand alone, where you wouldn't have had to read the first book in order to enjoy the second book. I think if you read the second book first, you'll know some things about the first book that you wouldn't know if you just started reading it cold. But they don't really depend on each other, and they're largely about different people. But above all, I can only really give the advice to readers that I give to other writers and try to take myself, which is read what you enjoy reading.
Yeah.
And write what you enjoy writing.
Well, thanks for...
And one of the wonderful things about science fiction is that it's not the stuff you read in class. It's not the stuff you read because you're supposed to, or because it's serious, or because it makes you look like an intellectual. It's the stuff you read because it's exciting and fun and interesting.
Yeah, and thanks for writing what I want to read, and I'm looking forward to more. So
Thank you so much.
Yeah, what's next?
Well, I'm working on a non-science fiction novel now. I like to switch off between the two. But the next science fiction novel that I'm thinking about writing is a novel set in the near future, perhaps 30 or 40 years from now. So it will be actually a separate, a different world, more like our world.
Great. And when can we expect your next novel or your next science fiction novel?
If only I knew.
Got it. Well, I wish you well with the research, and thanks so much for taking time out to talk with us here in Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much.